unlike the content of the previous talk, which showed how important nematodes are for really altering the soil environment and contributing to it, with ground nesting bees, to anything I know of, and I'll show you some evidence for it, they're really not, it's a substrate for nesting, but they're not really influencing that environment much. So for a soils person, may not be so interested, but bees are depending on soil attributes for their nesting success. But that won't be like what you just saw, which was quite fascinating. And we don't know much about interactions of ground nesting bees with nematodes. There's a very limited number of studies, but there's a lot more room for latitude there. So I'll start you with the familiar and lead you into the unfamiliar. And that's probably a fairly obvious tact, is to introduce the honeybee to you, which is the bee that most people know of, sometimes the only bee people know of. And the honeybee is about as good an example of a bee as a manatee is of a mammal. It's not a typical bee. It has perennial colonies. It is by necessity a broad floral generalist because it forages all season long. And most of you, certainly anyone who works with bees in this room, knows that they're not natives of the New World. They were brought here by Spanish missionaries and European settlers. But it's not that we have a lack of bees in the New World or in any other continent. In fact, there's a vast diversity of bees available with all sizes, all kinds of foraging habits, floral specializations or generalizations, and nesting habits. Just in Utah, which is a rather well-collected state because our lab has been there for a little over a half century, there's 900 known species within the state of Utah. So we don't lack for species diversity in much of North America. And in this picture, only one, well, two of those actually are not ground nesters. This is one I'd love to show to departments of vertebrate biology of one sort or another. They don't like it, but it's true. There's a lot of species of bees. There's a little over 20,000 named species of bees. The suspicion is if we knew all the bees on the planet, it might be more like 25,000 or 30,000 species. And of those, at least estimating from the only complete fauna of bees, which is in eastern North America, over a large area, is eastern North America with a very ambitious two-volume study by Ted Mitchell. In that eastern North America, we estimate about 85% of the species are ground nesters. And I imagine in most parts of the world, the majority of species are ground nesters. That might be an exception to that in some island systems. It would be interesting to know in tropical rainforests, but we don't. And for a ground nester, typically all you see on the surface, if it's a larger species and if rain or wind hasn't taken away the little tumulus, the pile of excavated soil from the central tunnel, you'll see little volcanoes like that, or something like it, or a delta-shaped one in sand with a very cylindrical hole, and that's indicative of the nest below. Sometimes they're fairly obvious, at least at the outset, such as this Anthophora nest, and you see that very cylindrical hole. As a forewarning, however, if you're interested in seeing for yourself the layout of a nest, you definitely want to intercept the resident bee coming or going from that tunnel, because that also could be a wolf spider burrow, it could be a tiger beetle burrow, and you could spend an hour or 2 hours excavating only to find out that it's not what you thought at the bottom of the hole. More commonly, because that was a big bee, and the honeybee is actually a big bee relative to the average size bee, and many bees, such as the sweat bees, are tiny. Pertida is tiny. And their holes, the hunt for their holes alone in a place makes looking for a needle in a haystack comparatively easy. Those are holes of nests of that little bee on the right who's on a blackberry flower. And if those of you can have seen blackberry flowerings, you can appreciate how small that bee is. And yet it's a ubiquitous genus. But unless you see activity at the entrance, either from resident bees coming and going, or their parasitic bees nosing around for a vacant nest or a nest where the mother bee's gone, if you don't see those, you'll never see the nesting holes unless it's a particularly populous aggregation. So finding them is difficult. Typically when we find them because we found multiple nests. There is no comprehensive survey for nesting biology and its variation across the range of any solitary ground nesting bee. Most of them are opportunistic finds, such as the one the founder of our lab, Ned Bohart, there on the right, and on the left, one of our participants in the bee course excavating a nest out by the Wilcox sand dunes in Arizona. But that's the typical position of somebody studying a ground nesting bee nest. Unless you are talented enough, patient enough, have the right system, you can get solitary bees, at least some, to nest between glass plates with the soil sandwiched between them. However, I forewarn you with that if you're off by a millimeter or so in that space, you either, the whole nest is hidden in the soil because it's a little too wide, or they refuse to nest because it's a little too narrow for their cell diameter. So it's very tricky, but if you can, I've not succeeded at it. Ty Rolston has in my lab some years ago with sweat bees, which is probably the best place to start with that. The genus Dialectis, now Lasioglossum again. There is one exception in terms of a convenient place to study ground nesting bees. This would be the seventh wonder of the world for bee biologists. It's unfortunately, there's no convenient way to have a large meeting there. This is in southeastern Washington near Walla Walla. And in that area, they've been growing alfalfa for seed since the 1960s. And at that time, noticed that this ground nesting bee, the alkali bee, Nomia melanderi, was an excellent pollinator and multiplied on alfalfa where they planted it. And so, as I'll show, I've surveyed all the active and past active nesting sites, and the number's astronomical in terms of the number of nesting bees there. Now it's a little bit over 20 million nesting females in this area. On the upper corner, there's one nesting bed. They're maintained vegetation-free, which is essentially alkali bee. The name comes from the fact in nature would nest in an alkali flat in the Great Basin, so something with a salt surface and moist soil underneath it, and fairly bare surface, or maybe with saltgrass on the surface. They make those nest tumuli like you see in the upper left. The largest nesting bed, it's not the largest now, there's another bigger one, had about 5 million nesting females. It's like walking through an apiary when it's active. It's you have to be there to experience it. You can see the nesting beds from aerial photographs, black and white aerial photographs. It's the white against the dark of the crop. And part of the reason it's white is because since these aren't natural alkali flats, these are in these deep silt soils, beautiful soils for growing alfalfa, growers have to add salt to that surface. Yes, at least at the outset, something like 1/4 pound per square foot every couple of years. So those sacks on the right came by railroad up there, 1 ton each. They put out that year over 30 tons of salt on these nesting beds. What that does, and the research was done, beautiful studies, group of studies by Bill Stephen that essentially figured out how to provide artificially sub-irrigated nesting beds that the bees like, that sodium chloride will, with calcium salts only in the soils, you get a fluffy surface in these silts that the bees don't like to nest in. It's a thick, dusty surface. And the sodium chloride will lay that flat and also prevent evaporation at the same time, such that you have a nice moist soil underneath that comes from hydraulic lift in those silts rather than from precipitation, which is oftentimes fairly disastrous from the bees. I've also done tensiometer surveys of these nesting beds to look at soil moisture, because they want a fairly moist soil. And if you have the right soil moisture at around 22 kilopascals, as you can see in the horizontal bar at the top, that's the nesting density for just surveys in the bed. So that's about 50 nests per square meter. And if you have, for instance, a failed sub-irrigation system and it soaks the nesting bed, is much less nesting. More commonly, too little water delivered to that nesting bed, it gets too dry. The bees don't like to nest in that, or they will dig deeper if they can to try to find that moist layer. But done right, the longest going nesting bed that I know of there, because most of them, if they've failed, it's because they've been abandoned over the decades from the family or the people who have bought that farm or descendants in the family. But the longest living bed has been going for over 60 years and typically has about 1/3 to 1/2 million nesting bees in it. And they get superb pollination service all for the cost of a sub-irrigation system and surface salt, and sacrificing maybe 1% of their property for the nesting bed. When it's done right, there's a very successful nesting bed. You can't walk across that bed without stepping on nests. The densest I've ever measured was over 1,000 nests per square meter, which is very hard to measure, the count, because essentially it's tumulus on top of tumulus. You don't see a bare soil surface anywhere. And underground, cumulatively over the years, it becomes like a Swiss cheese of old nest cells and contents. Be interesting to know what all is living in that. That's the female there on the right. Doesn't really do her justice. They're very distinctive bees. They have a metallic pearly colored green or pearly colored gold bands on the abdomen. There's only, I believe, two species of bee in North America that have that. And one of them is Nomia melandri, and the other one's a close relative. The question came up with growers there. Some of their beds, they have lacustrine built hard pans underneath some of these from the Pleistocene floods and early Holocene floods that came down the Columbia River and down the Snake River. And they were concerned that the depth of nesting soils above that seemed to be getting, in their impression, thinking back to their childhood, was getting thinner and it was interfering with nesting success. And so it brought to mind the idea of bioturbation, which we think of with worms, where they're not only churning soil, but bringing stuff to the surface. And this was one of the, if you haven't read it, it's a fascinating study by Charles Darwin that most people don't pay attention to, but it was Darwin's illustration of how a slow, measurable, constant process can result in very large transformations, in this case the subsidence of boulders in chalk fields in Kent, as a result of burrowing by worms year after year, decade after decade, century after century. And it's a really neat study of his to show the inexorable march of change that seems very small in our short time perspective. And so I measured that. About two-thirds of the nests in those nesting beds, females go back down the natal burrow, the emergence burrows of their cohort, but about a third of them in a populous bed have to excavate a new nest. And they bring up that tumulus, and in some years most of that stays put, in some years there's high winds or rain and that washes off or blows away. And so the question was, well, is this contributing to the loss of soil in these nesting beds? And it's a dramatic amount of soil that's moved. This has not been measured before by other bees because it's not so, most places on such convenient systems, but it's nearly 100 tons of dirt brought to the top by these bees from their little tumuli, just because there's so many bees. But that adds up to very little in the way of soil loss, presuming all of it blows away or is washed away. So in general, I don't think bees are doing much to transform soils in their nesting activities. It's a one-way street. They're benefiting from soil attributes, but they're really not, that I can see, and maybe someone in here will find a different result, but I don't see how they're affecting them much. There's one exception, a transformation from a human perspective that's mischievous with bees, which is in archaeological sites, ground nesting bees will take modern pollens and put them down 1 to 2 feet in their nest cells. And paleontologists and archaeologists coming along and wondering, well, what was the flora 5,000 years ago or 1,000 years ago at this site, are very confused by that. And you'll find there's 3 or 4 papers in the smaller aspects of the archaeological literature that address this. But they can cause a lot of mischief in that regard. That's probably their biggest influence in soil. In terms of soil preferences, starting with my dissertation work and doing some in subsequent years, whenever I'd excavate a nest, I also take a scoop of the soil in a watertight jar and later on measure moisture content and then do textural analysis. And most of the bees that I studied from New York State, from Kansas, from southeastern Arizona, were nesting in soils that were sandier, sand or siltier. So loams, silty loams, sandy loams, occasionally clay loams, and then often to quite sandy soils or silty soils. And that might be a bias, but if you look at the soil map on the right, which is fairly coarse, of course, clays aren't that abundant, at least on surfaces. And loams and sandy loams and silt loams are the prevalent soils in North America. It would be interesting for those of you that are in places that have really clay soils to look for nesting by bees. I predict you'd have at least lazy glossom sweat bees, but it'd be interesting what other bees are retained or excluded by an area that's strictly clay soils. That said, I guess I'll show it in a bit. For bees, the texture is all a local phenomena. And so national maps of soils like that really don't tell you much about what bees have available. You have to get to a bee scale. If they have if it's a county that's all clay soils and there's an area the size of this room with sand, there will be sand nesting bees in that county. Nesting depths of bees are oftentimes somewhat taxon-specific, species-specific, sometimes genus-specific, sometimes not. Typically, it seems that they are digging to a depth where they're trying to find a suitable moist soil. Oftentimes, they're going through drier surface layers to reach a more consistently damp, deeper layer. And I'll show you a little bit of evidence as to why they do that. Shallowest nests of some species, sometimes in sand, sometimes in very hard clays. They might only be 5 centimeters down. Some cavity nesting genera, like Osmia and Megachile, they also have ground nesting representatives. They'll be shallow. But some bees will go very deep. The deepest recorded that I know of is over 2 meters. And the really deep ones are always in sands, because obviously that's where you can go deeper. If you were out there with a shovel, you can go deeper in a damp sand than you can in a hard clay. Why are they seeking that moisture? There's three disparate studies. They're all with helictid bees. Two of them were done with observation nests I described. I believe with the Evelias it was not. And the curious result that these people found, and I'll bet you they first questioned their original weighing. So they weighed, on the left there is a provision mass made of pollen with nectar, and with the mother bee will lay an egg on that. That's an alkali bee nest cell. And then the larva feeds on that. And what they found, quite remarkably, is that the mature larva, post-feeding and before it's defecated, or the mature larva plus its feces, weighed half again as much as the weight of the food mass they were given. And these people concluded, and Dorothy Mason did some elegant studies back in the 70s with this to demonstrate it, they're depending on the soil atmosphere to be contributing moisture, probably by the hygroscopicity of that provision mass, since it's got a sugary solution in it, and it's taking moisture out of the soil atmosphere. She showed that if the nest cell, the humidity in that nest cell drops below 95%, the larva dies. And another student, Alvin Shin, there working with a different bee in the genus Calliopsis, showed that if there was a condensation droplet inside the nest cell that plopped onto the provision mass, it would mold, and they would die. So they're going to a depth with a uniform temperature and a high humidity, presumably for that purpose, but no, there's another 12,000 species of ground nesting bee at least in which that's an open question. But it certainly sounds likely, and it would explain why they're looking for those moist depths. In contrast with a cavity nesting bee, and this is work from Jordi Bosch, is more what you'd expect. So the provision mass for this bee is about 0.5 gram, and the resultant larva plus its frass is about 1/3 of a gram. Why they don't need the extra moisture, why those ground nesting bees do need the extra moisture, we don't know any of that. It's just, I hadn't thought about this question from this perspective until preparing for this talk. Soil is a great buffer for ground nesting bees. It actually provides them a very ideal habitat relative to bees nesting above ground, specifically twig nesting bees who are really whipsawed by environmental conditions. So in the wintertime, and these are, I have temperature records from basins in northern Utah. In wintertime, the ground only freezes near the surface. In most places, it freezes at all. And down at nesting depth, it's a nice uniform temperature. So for instance here, this is an NRCS reporting station. And in the kind of gold color with the jagged teeth, that's air temperatures. That's what a twig nesting bee is experiencing through the winter. And it's going down quite cold. For two different species of Osmia, the point at which their ice crystallizes in their bodies is around -17 to -20°C. So that could be a risky temperature to be a twig nesting bee. On the other hand, the ground nesters, which are the green and the black lines up above, notice that they barely touch freezing, and yet they don't fluctuate either. They're very uniform. And particularly, you can see, you can see where the jaggedness of that green line suddenly smooths out. That's once there's a snowpack. Under that snowpack, a blanket of snow is actually a very apt name for what it is. It makes a very uniform temperature environment for a ground nesting bee, so it's very favorable. We've been working with wood nesting bees at that thermistor system on the right there, and especially in Utah, in a sunlit tree trunk, the fluctuations in temperature over the course of a day in the dead of winter is phenomenal. It can swing by 50 degrees Fahrenheit in the course of a day with hot sun on that bark on the south side. Ground nesting bee is just uniform and happy. At the other extreme, it's the same reason, for fire going over the surface. Obviously, a twig nester is doomed. A wood nester, it's complex, but a ground nester, it turns out if they're below a temperature, a depth of 5 to 10 centimeters, and there isn't a very thick litter layer on top, they're safe from the lethal heat of fire. And this illustrates that. This is from Leonard Dabano's work in Chaparral, which has a much higher litter, a thicker, more volatile leaf litter layer on the surface, so it burns hotter. But even in a light burn, the gold line there is the temperature at just 5 centimeters depth. And it's nearly or is a benign temperature for a bee. They'll survive that. They can survive to 45 to 48 degrees C, eggs or larvae or pupae or adults. Whereas at the surface, that'll kill, obviously, 700 degrees C in an intense burn. But if they're ground nesting, it turns out they come up the next year. And this is a burn near us in the Cache Valley, burned in September. This is a spring flying bee, so its nesting season was long over. This is the following spring, and all those little white spots are fresh soil tumuli, like you see in the picture there, on the black ashy surface of this sage steppe there in Utah. So they're completely untouched by the fire. Again, soil being the great moderator of environmental fluctuation. We, in general, don't know much of what we can do for ground nesting bees in a favorable way, either in our gardens, in landscaping, or in a farm setting. We know some things we shouldn't do. You'll hear some later today or tomorrow. Is that tomorrow? Today. Oh, later today, yeah. About some things we shouldn't do. In a landscaping setting, the obvious one is buried weed barrier. It's a disaster for ground nesting bees as well as worms and everything else. But what can we do favorably for bees? So this gave me the idea for this study. In a xeriscape garden at the back of our building, they used a pebble mulch, pebbles about the size of Oreos, and flat, they were stream pebbles. And this bee, Helictis rubicundus, piled into that xeriscape garden. They weren't there before because it was lawn. And within a year or two, there were well over 400 nests. And a lot of the nests were tucked against the pebbles. So I thought I would pursue that. And I had another nesting aggregation I had found on campus along the sidewalk, between the sidewalk and a cemetery fence. Aggregations over 200 meters long, about 6 feet deep. And I could put out replica treatments with stream pebbles in subplots with a paired subplot next to it, in which I left it as bare dirt. And I could do 25 of those randomized position down the sidewalk. Looks like that. And you can see the nesting on the right at the boundary between the two, all the nests around the stones versus scattered nests in the bare dirt. And this is for an existing aggregation. To do an experiment like this where there is no aggregation, it's confounded with your long wait for colonization. This bee might colonize it quickly, but a lot of bees, you can put it out there, but there's no guarantee that a colonist will find it and start to multiply there. So I did before measurement on my plots, before I added the pebbles in the preceding summer, and you can see the nesting was almost exactly even on average between the two sides of the plots. I added pebbles to one side, and those are the ones that are in the textured bars. That following spring, I should mention, this is a primitively eusocial bee, so in the fall, females mate and fly away from the aggregation to winter someplace else. It's very poorly understood. And then they come back in the spring. And you can see the majority came back and decided to nest against the pebble in that square as opposed to the bare dirt next door to it. That pattern persisted through the summer, and was repeated the next year. Thereafter, landscaping came in with about 3 inches of bark mulch and buried the whole thing. So, but I got my data out of it nonetheless. And meanwhile, they accommodated me in another spot where they turfed the whole aggregation, but they left and built a rock layer and soil at the bottom. So they redeemed themselves, perhaps. It was certainly busy last year. To look at it another way, if you look at the pairs, comparing the two, the nesting density was always, in every single case of all 25 of them, I had to abandon one, so 24, was always denser on the pebble side, sometimes greatly so, sometimes less so, but always the preference for nesting against the pebbles, which begs the question of why. And I was thinking, and it turns out it was naively, there was a temperature gain, because these bees start nesting in early to late March. The snow's only melted out for the last couple weeks. It can be cold. It turns out it doesn't matter. So I took thermistor temperature readings in the entrances to those nest tunnels, either in the bare dirt or against the pebble. And it turns out it really doesn't matter in terms of temperature. The bee would be experiencing the same thermal gain on a sunny day, whether it's in the bare dirt or it's against the pebble. And I tried it in two different days, two different temperatures. And you see there's a huge gain over air temperature. To sit in that nest entrance is nice and toasty, and then once they're out flying, it's cold. But against the pebble didn't matter. Now, there are a couple of other studies with more larger rock cobble who suggest that there is a thermal gain, work in Canada. And it was nicely done work, so there might be more to be learned here. But my impression from this study is, at least for pebbles of this size, it really doesn't matter. And so I don't know why. It may be for prevention of cave-in, it may be for visual orientation, I'm not sure. So some reasons why bees, so many species of bees, are ground nesters. Obviously there's soil everywhere, whereas beetle burrows and deadwood or pithy twigs in which to nest are a more finite nesting substrate. Furthermore, soil is a great buffer for the environmental vagaries that happen at or above the surface. This soil atmosphere thing and moisture for larval development needs a lot more exploration, I think. An obvious one is they can make a nest cell exactly to fit the size of their larva. Whereas in a cavity nesting bee, sometimes they can modify the dimensions of the cavity. Oftentimes they're constrained by it and they get smaller or bigger progeny depending on the cavity diameter size. There are challenges with flooding and erosion, and those can be good and bad. It depends on the context. But the biggest challenge probably is microbial and pathogen. And that there's only been a few studies, but with molecular techniques now, I think we'll be able to get a lot more understanding of it. It would also be nice to be able to translate the things we measure about soil, like texture, into the relevant attribute that the bee is seeking. I think there's room for that in a large way. And so what I can say is that if you're interested in ground nesting bees, or if you're interested in the majority of bees in what you're studying for bee communities, you really ought to do yourself the favor of at least contributing to the literature by describing the nesting biology of another species of ground nesting bee. And I'll stop there.
All right, thanks. Any questions for Jim?
Back corner.
Yes, and please repeat the question.
So you have that data on Halictus. How would you speculate on, say, an ingredient? Is there literature on this kind of pebble?
Right. What is needed, because I don't know. I wouldn't speculate on it because it's only one species. And it's a very ubiquitous species, both in North America and Europe. If you find the context of a nesting aggregation, it's a very easy experiment to deploy, and I would think we at least want to know for several other families of bees some representatives. I might go back to that Andrine aggregation I showed you the picture of, if it's populous enough, but it's ripe for an experiment. I can tell you it's a very satisfying experiment. It was easy to implement.
So I'd like to talk to you.
Yeah. Yes, Corey.
So Jim, in Florida, when I tell people, you know, they have 320-ish species of bees, and probably they're mostly ground nesters, and I think that's a dark number, but we know there's three to four times as
Oh, it can be greater depth. And your point, for sure, I think is well taken. I've seen a context with blueberries in southern Georgia in pine flatwoods, in which their water table, they're planting into ridges of soil with the blueberries, and the water table is about a foot down. And one of the bees that you know of, Haverpoda laboriosa, is a prevalent bee in Alabama and a lot of other places at blueberries, it nests down about 2 feet. And the only place it was nesting was at a distance from that blueberry field under a pavilion that was on raised soil. So I tried to find a context where I could see where ground nesting bees were eliminated in Okefenokee Swamp. But it turns out they could find places on those islands, even the smaller islands, that had a deep enough soil that they could nest. But that I think Florida would be an interesting place to explore that question, especially places where you know there's a shallow water table. And you can oftentimes make good ideas, especially from the east, on nesting depths and see if those bees are excluded. I'll bet you they are.
All right, thanks. That's all the time we have for questions. Thanks again, Jim. Nice talk.